for 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware. I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded on July 15th, 2018, and produced by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, Rachel and Nate joined me to talk about historical Plains and Prairie populist organizing and elections in the U.S. and Canada. That's all coming up on Arsenal for Democracy. Episodes are available for download on Tuesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes or Stitcher. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it simultaneously from WVUD.org on Tuesdays at noon Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is Arsenal for Democracy. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me again in studio this week is Nate. Hello, Nate.
Hey, Bill.
And on the line from Idaho is Rachel. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Bill. Hi, Nate.
So we're getting back into talking about regional sort of populists and left-wing movements in the United States, and this week a little bit into Canada since there was some overlap there. So we're talking about sort of a broad area with somewhat similar political alignments and issue interests and stuff. We're talking about the Plains and Prairie regions in the United States and southern Canada in sort of the middle of Canada. So we're talking like North Dakota, South Dakota, Nebraska, Kansas, Iowa, Minnesota, a little bit eastern Montana, Manitoba, Saskatchewan, some parts of Alberta, that sort of thing. We're only doing a half hour, so it's not certainly going to be comprehensive by any stretch, and some of those states we're probably not really going to get to, but we're going to just kind of touch on some various different elements from around this region that we found particularly interesting. And again, we'll have links up at arsenalfordemocracy.com where you can, like, you know, learn more about the stuff that we kind of glide over here. You know, this is just sort of an overview of this particular region. Now, a lot of the time on this show, we've talked about sort of the 1890s, maybe a little bit before then, the early 1900s, sort of before World War One. A lot of this is going to cover sort of that World War One, 1920s, 1930s era that we haven't touched as much on. But we are going to start by talking some about the 1890s. So you might recall that Rachel and I had done an episode where we talked in some detail about the sort of populist party and the populist movement, which was very strong in a lot of this region, although we were talking about it in the context of other parts of the United States. That was sort of a big thing around the 1890s, and that's where we want to start talking about that. So we'll just kind of recap some of that stuff. You might remember that we were talking about it in the context of like mining and stuff like that before, but this is going to be, again, more about those, you know, the farmers' interests, the railroad issues that affected farmers, that sort of thing. So Nate, where do we start on this?
Yeah, well, I have an article here from interesting the South Dakota Historical Society, and it sort of contrasts the reasons why populism succeeded in North Dakota succeeded in South Dakota and failed in North Dakota rather, and sort of goes over the history of the independent movement there, the populists, and different reasons why. For example, in North Dakota, where there was an attempt to do some sort of fusion with the Prohibitionists and later the Democrats, it sort of they wound up having getting a governor from the Independent Party, but he sort of campaigned on populist issues, but never really embraced them fully, and never really embraced the Omaha platform that Rachel's going to talk about shortly, and sort of ended up there's like political cartoons from back in the day sort of demonstrating the fusion aspect that didn't really seem to work out. So it comes out of a lot of these farmers alliances that we'll talk about more when it comes to Canada, but rather in South Dakota it did seem like things ended up somewhat more successful. So this is specifically in the 1890s, the South Dakota People's Party, they had their founder Henry Lukes, editor of the Dakota Ruralist, and he forged an ideology that moved South Dakota populism beyond the Omaha platform and towards a humanitarian concern for the toiling masses. and he has a there's a lot of good quotes from him here, but they were sort of echoing General Farmers Alliance and populist demands. After 1892, they placed more emphasis on socializing the capitalistic system. The question of for the American citizen to decide, he said in before the election of 1894, which system of paternalism does he prefer, special or general, for the few or for the many? I think we've heard something like that recently. So, basically taking on a pretty strong sort of very Plains-influenced populism, and ended up electing a great number of people to, so there was elections for governor. I think there was even a senator at one point, but definitely a couple people of like the railroad board, a couple congressmen that were elected on the people's platform. And so they eventually got the governor, populist Andrew E. Lee. And so he got control of the governorship and was writing about how there's a struggle going on between the money power seeking further power and people struggling across purposes to maintain their rights belong to the common people. Even actually, I found this interesting. He this was right around the time of the Spanish-American War, 1898, and he was warning the moneyed interests in the East should not be make a financial conquest for the rich fields that have been drenched with the blood of soldiers who fought for humanity, not to advance the interests of money. And so, sort of a large vision there. It's interesting to this is going on halfway around the world, but he was talking about the people aspire to something better than they have. He declared they yearn for a higher state. They demand more benefit life. And so they thought populism could best achieve that. And so this is sort of an interesting look at sort of the differences between how populism developed in the North versus South Dakota. And this is sort of an interesting time where that was pretty much the high point of populism, especially in this area.
Now, Nate alluded to the Omaha platform. Rachel, do you want to tell us about that?
Yeah, we kind of touched on some of the tenets of it when we were talking about the Idaho populist movement. So they called for a safe, sound, and flexible national currency, assistance to farmers with the financing of their labors. In a nod to the more urban areas, they called for a fair and liberal pension for ex-Union soldiers and sailors, the direct election of senators, single-term limits for presidents and vice presidents, the legislative principles of initiatives and referenda, secret ballots, nationalizing the railroads, the telegraph, and the telephone systems, postal banking, a graduated income tax, and the free and unlimited coinage of silver. In referencing the Omaha platform, Senator George Norris of Nebraska suggested the wealth of the super rich had to begin flowing to all the people from whom it was originally taken. So I think we kind of touched on it on our last populist episode. In 1892, there was a populist candidate, James B. Weaver. He received over 1 million votes and won 4 states, Colorado, Kansas, Idaho, and Nevada, and 22 electoral votes. The party's legislative majorities were able to elect United States senators. And so that 1892 election was kind of the high watermark for a third party after the Civil War. In the 1896 election, the populists abandoned the Omaha platform and endorsed Democratic nominee William Jennings Bryan on the basis of a single plank free silver platform. So they kind of took their focus away from all those from the many issues that I enumerated and just kind of focused on a silver backed currency farmers were often in a lot of debt because at this time there were a lot of droughts and there was a general economic depression. And so these farmers were in a lot of debt. And so they kind of hitched their star to the wagon of William Jennings Bryan and the silver-backed currencies. So they would inflate the money supply to kind of reduce the impact of their debt. William Jennings Bryan was very unsuccessful in his run, and that kind of spelled the beginning of the end to the populist party on the national stage, but they did continue to have success in the more regional and local arenas.
Now, I think we can jump ahead a little bit and talk about that era around just before, during, and after World War I. This is when some of those folks, well, broader nationally, you have the progressive movement continuing to pass various reforms at the national level. But in some of these specific states, for example, North Dakota, we'll talk about, you had folks that were kind of forming these similar, like, populist sort of organizing movements, but then drifting toward electoral politics after initially kind of being reluctant to pursue that route again, because, as Rachel just noted, that hadn't been necessarily successful before, apart from, you know, that they would sometimes get a senator here and there, or maybe a congressman. But you also have basically a bunch of like socialist organizers who had been involved in socialist party politics start working on organizing these folks in these rural areas, in these plain states and prairie states. The Nonpartisan League was founded in 1915 in the United States. Arthur C. Townley was an organizer for the Socialist Party of America. We've talked about this before, how this is a different group, but similar demands as before, right? State control of mills, grain elevators, banks, other farm-related industries, wanting to reduce the power of corporate political interests. They were particularly resentful of sort of the big money interests in Minneapolis and Chicago, probably New York as well to a lesser extent. Then this sort of starts spreading and expanding a bit. There's actually a pretty interesting article that just came out in May of 2018 by Michael Lansing in Zocalo, publicsquare.org. It's an essay, "When North Dakota Farmers Blew Up Partisan Politics, Early 20th Century Landowners Pushed Back Against Crony Capitalism." Obviously I can't, you know, read from the whole thing here, but they've got a lot of discussion of this sort of huge heterogeneous population of farmers, especially immigrant farmers from all these different European cultures. And other places, you also had African-American farmers. And then, of course, acknowledging here that a lot of this land was stolen from the Native Americans, who might have been part of that picture, except that they were largely being forced aside or already had been. But the Nonpartisan League initially abhorred electoral politics, he says. They said it was too corrupt and there was, you know, the power politics of it all was very distasteful. But their initial strategy was just sort of organizing. So wheat farmers in North Dakota, Minnesota, South Dakota, and Montana responded to their economic plight by organizing themselves into cooperatives and attempting to build power without getting involved in politics. And they had various, like, co-ops, equity exchanges. You end up with the a state-owned bank in North Dakota for farming purposes. But they ended up winning the governor's race when they did get involved pretty quickly. After all, in electoral politics, they won the governor's race in North Dakota, and they won a majority of the House of Representatives in 1916. So remember, this is just before World War One, or well, World War One is happening in Europe, but the U.S. didn't get into it until 1917. It says by 1918, they held those statewide offices and seized a majority of seats in the state Senate as well. Finally empowered to make their platform real, the newly elected farmers moved quickly to sidestep the large millers and traders in Minneapolis. They established a state-run terminal grain elevator and matched it with a state-run flour mill, keeping more profits from processed wheat in North Dakota. And then at this point, as I mentioned earlier, they moved toward creating a state-owned bank for local lending and financing so they don't have to deal with the out-of-state interests. And at this point is when it starts to spread to the other states. He says 12 other states. And as we'll talk about in just a second, it spreads to two Canadian provinces. So that's why, unusually, we're bringing up Canada in this case, because there is cross-border influence there. There was a great article that I've read before that I was having trouble finding that actually talks about how some of the farmers went across from, like, North Dakota and northern Minnesota and resettled in the Canadian provinces and got really involved in sort of the populist politics there. But I wasn't able to find that article at the time that we're recording this, so I'm just going off the stuff mentioned in this more recent article. The other interesting thing they mention here is that the NPL-controlled state house in North Dakota blocked local law enforcement from engaging in unconstitutional activities as part of the first Red Scare against sort of communists and socialists that was happening in World War One. Then they started struggling a bit because they started proposing some business schemes related to the league, and you know, I don't know if that was like just intended to enrich the league, or if these by business schemes is a little vague here. I don't know if that maybe just means more like state-owned things. But basically, there was concern by many of the members that this was overreaching what they had all agreed to. A lot of the farmers started turning against them. And they actually, this, you know, kind of shows how quick this rise and fall was. 1916 is when they start coming to power. By 1921, they held the first recall election in the country. Recall elections had been introduced by the progressive movement. And they recalled their own governor because they were upset about how things were going. And that was sort of the high watermark for the league. However, it is worth noting that the nonpartisan league eventually survives today as part in North Dakota as part of the Democratic Party, the Democratic Nonpartisan Party, which is kind of a funny way of referring to that, since obviously nonpartisan joined in to a different party. But that that was sort of an interesting thing there. And then again, as I said, you end up with the Alberta Nonpartisan League in Canada. They moved into federal politics and renamed themselves in 1917, so just like a year later, as the Farmers Nonpartisan Political League, again promoting roughly similar interests. And some of these things end up getting absorbed into wider political movements as well within Canada, and we'll circle back to some of that again later. You also have, around the same time, you have the Minnesota Farmer Labor Party, which that's another one that survives today as part of the DFL, the Democratic Farm Labor Party in Minnesota. But that's happening around the same time in the neighboring state of Minnesota. 1918 to 1944 was their run as an independent party. And they elected a whole bunch of people over the course of the 1920s and 1930s, 3 Minnesota governors, 4 U.S. senators, 8 U.S. representatives, and a majority in the Minnesota legislature. And they were even more closely affiliated with the existing sort of socialist and labor currents that were happening in other parts of the country. They end up the Farmer Labor Party as a whole, the national party from 1918 to 1936, was basically centered in Minnesota, but they merged together these sort of farmer interests with the existing labor party, which was, you know, sort of a federation of all these different labor unions and socialists on like the East Coast and places like that. And the Farmer Labor Party as a whole had state and local organizations for a while in Minnesota, Colorado, Utah, Illinois, Kentucky, Montana, New York, Pennsylvania, Oklahoma, Missouri, Washington, the Dakotas, and elsewhere. This is according to the Wikipedia page here. Their real strong power base was, of course, in Minnesota, and is very closely tied as well to sort of the rise and fall of events toward the Depression, because farmers were particularly hard hit. And like, you can look and see the peak years of their performance in terms of electing people to the U.S. House of Representatives was like 1932 and 1936, both years when FDR was on the ballot. So that's the Farmer Labor Party. And again, a lot of sort of cross-pollination happening at the same time, not just between North Dakota and Minnesota, but also north across the border into Alberta, Saskatchewan, Manitoba, these places. So that's sort of, again, we're moving pretty quickly here. This is just sort of like a very brief overview of some of these elements. But let's talk a little bit about sort of the Depression era in the 1930s. While we're talking about Minnesota, Nate, let's talk about that the strike that happened in Minnesota in 1934.
Right. Yeah. So I'm actually looking through someone's like master's thesis, going really deep into the Farmer Labor Party and specifically the politics of labor militancy in Minneapolis, 1934 and 1938, sort of tracking the rise and somewhat fall of the Farmer Labor Party, and specifically the Minneapolis General Strike of 1934, which was a Teamster strike against most of the trucking companies. Because Minneapolis is a major distribution center for the upper Midwest. And from May 16th, 1934, for a couple months, there was a large strike, and it was primarily led by Trotskyists. So a group that later founded the Socialist Workers Party of the United States and had recently split off from the Communist Party of America and became the Communist League of America, left opposition. This is, of course, after Trotsky was expelled from the Communist Party. And there was specific local 574 that were heavily involved and became quite militant. They were organizing coal drivers and various other for the strike. And eventually the police, so it was quite effective at first, and the police were sort of beating people up, trying to get the people that were preventing strike breakers from unloading trucks and such. And at one point, the police were just gunning people down in the street with shotguns and things like that. And several people died on Bloody Friday. So eventually there was some negotiations, and at one point, the martial law basically had to be declared. So the former labor governor, of course, declared martial law. That sort of speaks to the conflicts between some more social Democrats and more radical communists. And, you know, there was a fair amount. But I think eventually, you know, some union leaders were arrested, kept in stockades at the state fairgrounds at one point. Their headquarters was seized. But eventually it worked, and the negotiations, basically, they got a lot of what they wanted in terms of, so it was initially an open shop citadel under the control of the Citizens Alliance. In the aftermath of the strike, thousands of other workers in other industries organized with the assistance of Local 574 and gave the Communist League a very strong position in Local 574 and other Teamsters unions. So it was, I would say, a fairly successful strike in terms of getting most of the major demands. So the Citizens Alliance eventually had to incorporate the union's major demands. And eventually, settlement was ratified, and the back of employer resistance to unionization in Minneapolis was broken. And so eventually, however, some of these more radical unions were victims of the Anti-Radical Smith Act, which is, of course, the sort of anti-communist thing, that legislation that was eventually struck down by the U.S. Supreme Court, I believe. But yeah, 215 people were indicted, and this was around in that era, I think, enacted in 1940. But yeah, communist anarchists, fascist, eventually struck down in 1957. So I would say that's sort of a big flashpoint in terms of these types of confrontations. And I did hear about this story a little while ago, and I found it very interesting. Sort of like, it's the high point of Trotskyism in the United States, probably, in terms of shutting down a major city. And this was sort of right where that was a pretty salient difference. Like, were you still with the Stalinists, or are you Trotskyists, or all of that? So thought that was a interesting thing to bring up here.
And I think we sort of see, like, this is where 1930s is probably where you start seeing more and more divergence between sort of the Canadian trends and the U.S. trends, because that anti-communism, anti-socialism stuff just keeps ramping up more and more in the United States. And there was a little bit more flexibility in the Canadian side, more social democratic currents. At that point is when you see these sort of like hybrid agrarian social democratic socialist kind of things, like the forming into like the Cooperative Commonwealth Federation, which was this 1932 political party centered in Alberta. But before then, you know, in the 1920s, it had been a lot more similar probably to some of the sort of agrarian populist stuff that was happening in like North Dakota and Minnesota. Before the sort of everyone merged together into some pretty, you know, relatively successful political parties that end up, later becoming the NDP, which is still a major party in Canada today. You had these sort of other tendencies. I think, Nate, you had highlighted some of these in the notes as well. Like the United Farmers of Alberta was sort of a faction that they existed for a while. I think they were founded in 1909, but they sort of,
in the 20s,
but their heyday is kind of in that like 1917, that like World War I into the 1920s era, winning majority governments. A lot of times, like, they were winning without really being prepared. They didn't have leadership lined up. They would just suddenly be in power and not really sure what to do, but they kept on trying and succeeding for a while. But then the reason that these parties sort of start transitioning into other directions, away from this sort of agrarian populism model that had been working before, is because the Depression, although it, you know, maybe made some of these issues more, even more popular, it also hurt the ability to engage in organizing. It hurt the ability to build and maintain political power because a lot of these farmers were struggling so much. In Canada in particular, where they had actually been really in power, you know, they were the government. And so when the government was struggling, trying to figure out what to do with, you know, all these problems building up during the Depression, they were kind of hard pressed to figure out what to do. And you have to wonder, like, what would have happened in the United States if in that period, you know, these agrarian populists had been really in power. You know, maybe they would have also faced some of the similar declines and sort of collapsed in electoral politics. It's hard to know, but they didn't really quite take off in the same way that they did in Canada. But that's how you end up with that sort of gradual shift from this agrarian populism stuff into the more like social democratic mainline like parties that end up, you know, continuing to this day. You also had some areas like the Progressive Party of Saskatchewan, where like they were trying to replicate these similar models in the 1920s and into the 30s, and they just kind of never really pulled off the same successes as some of these other areas. And eventually a lot of these groups, you know, either splintered off into other things or merged into other things. But that it is interesting that that nonpartisan league, that farm labor party, like a lot of that was going back and forth across the border between Minnesota and North Dakota and, you know, these provinces in the middle of Canada. All right, Rachel, your closing thoughts on this as we wrap up here?
I just wanted to point out how kind of shocking learning about the Minnesota strike was, because we don't really learn in school that there was a thriving leftist movement. And I just wanted to kind of highlight that Jeremy Corbyn just got in a bit of a Twitter pickle, because he said schools should teach children about the trade union principles of solidarity and collective action, so they are equipped to uphold their rights as workers. And a lot of people kind of slammed him for those statements. But I just wanted to point out that learning about stuff like the Minnesota strike is very heartening for kind of our current struggles. And I think we should be educating ourselves on these leftist movements that we've had in our past. And it's kind of encouraging for the future.
And again, we apologize if we got some of the details wrong here, because we were trying to move pretty fast over a wide-ranging area, and there was a lot to cover in here. Again, we will have the links up at arsenalfordemocracy.com, so you can like read more about some of this stuff in more depth and firsthand and get resources to look around. All right, Nate, thank you so much for being here in studio with me.
Thanks, Bill.
And Rachel, thanks for being on the line.
Thanks, Bill.
That's all the time we have this week. Tweet us your comments at AFDRadio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from ArsenalForDemocracy.com on Tuesdays. You can hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Tuesday at noon Eastern. Our theme music was composed for us by Stuntbird. If there are articles or papers discussed in an episode, we usually post links to them on ArsenalForDemocracy.com along with each episode. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message.